I'm Susan Moran. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, March 26, 2024. Coming up, we'll discuss a positive and intriguing development, both for wildlife and people, as well as some roadblocks in the ongoing efforts to better manage and share water from the ever-shrinking Colorado River. Our guests are journalists Alex Hager of KUNC and Luke Runyon of CU Boulder's Water Desk. With a look at some of the recent news in science.
Intermittent fasting is popular in Colorado and around the nation. It involves things like skipping breakfast or skipping dinner and evening snacks, so there's more time fasting each day and less time eating. Short-term studies indicate health benefits from this practice that range from losing weight to lowering blood pressure. Now, a long-term study presented by the American Heart Association challenges those rosy benefits. The new study lasted roughly 10 years. It warns that limiting eating to an 8-hour window each day is associated with a 91% increase in risk of death from heart disease. That may sound scary, but statistics can be confusing. Actually, during the study, the vast majority of people who died of heart disease were not intermittent fasters. However, there was a somewhat higher rate of heart disease mortality among people who reported intermittent fasting compared with those who didn't. Maybe that's worth further study. Maybe. You see, it's not clear who actually did intermittent fasting because the researchers' categorization criteria was kind of sketchy. Keep in mind, this was a roughly 10-year study. Very early on, researchers asked each person, "When did you eat the day before?" A few days later, the researchers asked again, "Please recall, when did you eat yesterday?" Researchers used these early replies to identify intermittent fasters. The study lasted years, but they never asked again, "Are you still doing intermittent fasting?" Another problem is that no one knows what anyone in the study actually ate. Who chose salmon and salad for lunch, then skipped dinner and went to bed early? Who skipped every meal, then came home and binged on ice cream, donuts, soda, and French fries until 3 a.m.? To get better long-term data about intermittent fasting, perhaps the American Heart Association could consider funding more comprehensive studies. For How on Earth, I'm Shelley Schlender.
As solar panels become more widely used, researchers are looking for ways to make them more efficient. Most commercial panels available today, such as the ones you see mounted on rooftops of homes and businesses, are made from silicone and have an efficiency of about 20 to 25%. That means they convert only a fifth to a quarter of the incoming sunlight energy into electricity. As reported recently by the University of Colorado Boulder, one path could be to add a material called perovskite. Perovskite is one of the most common crystal structures found on Earth, making up about 38% of the mass of the planet, but tends to be buried deep, making up about 93% of the lower mantle of the Earth's interior, 660 kilometers below the surface. Metal halide perovskites are a unique class of photosensitive semiconductors. Scientists have been testing perovskite solar cells by stacking them on top of traditional solar cells to make tandem cells, layering the two materials, each absorbing a different part of the sun's spectrum, can potentially increase the panel's efficiency by over 50%. One difficulty in the commercial production of solar cells with perovskite is the coating process of the solar glass plates typically needs to keep them from reacting with oxygen, which would degrade the performance. The researchers found ways to mix other chemicals with the perovskite to keep it from oxidizing. This allows coating the cells in an environment with ambient air and improves the cell's performance stability. As mentioned by the CU Boulder report, tandem silicon perovskite cells could be more efficient and cheaper and have broader applications than existing silicon panels, including potential installation on the roofs of electric vehicles. They could add 15 to 20 miles of range per day to a car left out in the sun, enough to cover many people's daily commutes. Drones and sailboats could also be powered by such panels. The research results were published in the journal Nature Energy. In other news, on the science anniversary calendar, today, March 26th, is the birthday of mathematician Paul Erdős, who was the subject of the book titled The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, and also the birthdays of evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins and the University of Colorado Physics Nobel laureate Carl Wieman. For How on Earth, I'm Joel Parker.
You're listening to the KGNU Science Show. I'm Susan Moran. For more than two decades, the Colorado River has been shrinking thanks to climate change-induced drought, population growth, and some water mismanagement, among other things. Roughly 40 million people living in the seven states and some 30 tribes depend on the water. For many years, though, the states in the upper basin, that's Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, have been at odds with the lower basin states, California, Nevada, and Arizona, over who should do more to cut back on water use. Meanwhile, here in Colorado, cities and towns on the Front Range have clashed with those on the western slope over water use. Front Range cities, after all, get almost half of their water from the western slope through Trans Mountain diversions. My guests today are journalists who've been covering water issues in the West for many years. They recently collaborated on a feature about a surprising new deal in the Colorado River saga. Here's the gist. The Colorado River District, along with us, taxpayers, are paying the plant's operator, Xcel Energy, a lot, nearly $100 million, to keep returning water to the river from its hydroelectric facility off of I-70 near Glenwood Springs. That's great news for fish, as well as for the recreation industry and farmers and ranchers. To help us make better sense of this big development and how it fits into the broader context of the Colorado River crisis, we have Alex Hager. He's a reporter covering the Colorado River Basin for KUNC and many NPR network stations, and Luke Runyon, who co-directs the Water Desk. It's an initiative of the Center for Environmental Journalism at CU Boulder. Previously, he was managing editor and a reporter at KUNC covering Western water issues. And they both join us remotely, Luke from Grand Junction and Alex from Fort Collins. First, Alex Hager, welcome to How on Earth.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Luke Runyon, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hi, Susan. Thanks.
So I want to dive in, Alex Hager, starting with you. Just give us more of a nutshell of what's actually happening. This is pretty surprising.
Well, right now, the Colorado River is taxed beyond the level that we can sustain into the future. The demand on the river has far outstripped its supply as climate change has shrunk the amount of snow that falls in Colorado's mountains and melts to feed the water supply. And because of that, we are seeing some very tense negotiations up and down the river about who gets to use its water where. The cities, farms, and ranches that depend on it across those seven states, 30 tribes in Mexico, are all trying to get a slice of the pie, and the pie itself is shrinking.
And then it seems a little twist, and this is more about East and West Colorado, but it certainly fits into the broader picture. You produced this piece just a couple weeks ago on this purchase of Xcel Energy's pretty significant and senior water right. Basically saying, do nothing beyond what you've been doing, returning water to the river. Give us, sort of break it down, how this came to be and what's the gist of it?
That's right. So there's a hydroelectric generating station just outside of Glenwood Springs. It's in Glenwood Canyon. If you have driven I-70 from the eastern part of the state to the western part of the state, you have more than likely passed right by it and not even known it. It
Absolutely.
is
I've passed it so many times wondering what the heck is that?
That's right. It's a little brown building right on the side of the highway, and it does not generate a lot of electricity, but it holds the legal access to a ton of water because it pulls that water out of the Colorado River, runs it through hydroelectric turbines, and then puts every drop right back in the river. Because it's putting all those drops back in the river, people on Colorado's western slope, whether they be cities or farmers or even fish in the river, have come to depend on a lot of water that stays in western Colorado's portion of the Colorado River because it is getting used but not consumed at that power plant. So a coalition of farmers, ranchers, cities, and environmental advocates in western Colorado.
And I want to stop you right there because these are unlikely bedfellows to begin with. That seems like part of what's pretty surprising and great about this, right?
That's right. So you have a group of pretty diverse users putting their support behind a purchase of those water rights. The Western Slope has a lot of anxiety that Front Range cities, which are growing quickly and need as much water as they can get, might come in and purchase access to that water, freeing up more for themselves. The fear there is that if they did so, you would not have the water being put back into the river and you would not have dependable flows coming to the Western Slope. So this diverse group of users is putting a price tag on getting rid of that anxiety. And in this case, the price tag is $100 million. It is being spent by the Colorado River District, which is a taxpayer-funded agency which represents a lot of Western Slope water users. They are using $100 million, some from their own coffers and about 50 million from federal infrastructure spending, to buy the legal right to use that water from the power plant. And basically, just leave it in the river. They're going to lease it back indefinitely to Xcel Energy to produce hydropower. Really, all they care about is that whether it's going through the hydropower turbines or just flowing right on by the power plant, that it reaches Western Colorado in the Colorado River.
So basically, Alex, Xcel is getting paid to do nothing beyond what it has been doing. And is this in perpetuity, or can Xcel say, actually, we want to produce more, or for whatever reasons, we don't want to return the water or some of it anyway back to the river? Can that happen?
My understanding is that they are going to continue doing business as usual, and because the water is owned by the Colorado River District, or will be once this deal is closed, they will only be allowed to use as much as they have been leased back to them by the Colorado River District.
I see. And does, I know you're not an economist, but does this make economic sense for us all? I mean, this is taxpayers. I know some through federal programs, as you noted, some, well, eventually all through taxpayers.
Yeah, whether or not it makes economic sense is a matter of opinion. But I actually did talk to an economist about this, and in his opinion, it's in line with what we've seen other water users doing with big amounts of money. Because the river is shrinking, because there is steady demand on its water from growing cities and from farms and ranches that are, putting food on tables across the country. We are seeing those users clamoring for some peace of mind. They worry that in the long term, because there are so many people trying to grab a slice of the pie, theirs could go away, theirs could shrink. New legal agreements about how the water is shared could impact them negatively. So if there is an opportunity to buy some certainty, even if that opportunity comes at a great financial cost, a lot of water users are deciding that it's worth it.
Interesting. And Luke Runyon, I know you edited this piece and you've been covering Colorado River Basin issues for many years. This concept of, say, paying water rights holders, farmers, ranchers, and such, to do nothing beyond what they're already doing, or for that matter, to go let their fields go fallow to preserve habitat and such. It's nothing new. But does this stand out in a different way? And do you think this, I don't know, portends different kinds of agreements that will actually come up and ease the tension, the clash related to water scarcity, you know, between the eastern Colorado and the western slope?
Yeah, I think this is a great example of what's become kind of a feature of Colorado River conservation, not just in the state of Colorado, but throughout the entire basin, which is exactly what you said, paying users to forego some amount of water, and really incentivizing conservation in that way. I think what you found is that there's a lot of government entities, whether that's a state government or the federal government, being really reluctant to kind of crack a hammer down on water users throughout the West. You know, oftentimes we'll get questions of like, why don't we just mandate cuts, you know, kind of across the board? Well, that would be a really sticky political situation throughout the entire region. And so instead of going with the stick approach, oftentimes what you see is the carrot approach, where you know, you can offer up sums of money to various users in order for them to use less water. And you can kind of point to many different examples throughout the Colorado River watershed where that's the case, where you have federal dollars or state dollars or even local government dollars going to pay users to just leave water in the river, or leave water in large reservoirs that are in need of a boost.
Yeah, and along the lines of this carrot approach, it seems it's also an example of, I wouldn't say a shifting mindset, but how we all need to look, not just the policymakers, but a little differently. Like, it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. It can be yes and win-win. I mean, not to be Pollyannish, but like in this case, it doesn't sound like there's really a loser.
I mean, you're having to pay a lot of money for essentially the status quo in order to fit, you know, the strictures of what is a very complicated and Byzantine Western water governance system. And, you know, whether or not you're justified in spending that amount of money just to maintain a status quo, you know, that's kind of up for voters to decide whether or not this money is actually being well spent. And you know, it's, I think what's interesting about this particular case in Western Colorado is that we don't have a lot of data points on how much water is actually worth, you know, with this kind of market for water rights. Like, we don't necessarily always get, you know, like a printout of what's water going for on the Western slope. But here's one case where you can point to and say, oh, this water right in Western Colorado, it's very senior, you know, it's a highly valuable water right, went for $100 million. You know, that's one very interesting data point that, you know, journalists and water users throughout the West are going to be looking at and saying like, oh, this transition to using a lot less Colorado River water or paying for certainty is going to be a very expensive proposition.
Yeah. And Luke Runyon, I'll continue with you. I know, Alex, you alluded to this at the beginning that, I mean, despite a fairly abundant year of precipitation so far here, we're still in this prolonged, 20-year plus mega drought within the Colorado River Basin. And Luke, I just want you to put into perspective, like, what makes it such a crisis now? And I'm thinking myself and many listeners, no doubt, have visited or at least driven past like Lake Mead and Lake Powell, these huge water banks, and seen these kind of horrific, I mean, they're surreal looking bathtub rings showing how low, how much the water has dropped in really even quite recent years. So how do you lay out that scenario for us now to bring this all into the broader Colorado River Basin context?
Yeah, I mean, the Colorado River is a great example of what climate change is going to do in the West. You know, it's basically completely upending the water cycle in our region. And the way that that's showing itself is in these large reservoirs that we've built. You know, both Lake Mead and Lake Powell were built to be kind of this buffer between wet and dry years. You know, store up the water in wet years and draw it down in dry years. And it, you know, when you have a string of dry years, you lose that buffer. And that's essentially what we've seen in both Powell and Mead over the last 20 years. we're getting more and more dry years and fewer of the extremely wet years. And so you draw down that insurance policy, essentially, if you're not willing to curb your demand. And that's where a lot of the kind of policy negotiation in the river is right now, is figuring out how to kind of live within a shrinking Colorado River. And the focus of that is on demand. You know, that's really kind of the lever in this whole situation that we have control over. We can control how much water we're taking from the Colorado River. And so that's where, you know, these conservation deals that have been getting a lot of press over the last couple of years, that's what we're seeing, is how do we go about controlling our demand? Who has to take less water from the river under what condition? And so that's the state that we're in right now. We went through a really wet winter last year that boosted the reservoirs, but it did not pull mm-hmm. them anywhere close to being full.
Mm-hmm. And I just want you to touch on this, Luke, even though this could be multiple shows all in one, but it just seems one of the elephants in the room anyway is massive population growth. I mean, along the Front Range is obvious, but throughout the Southwest, Arizona, in an area that's just becoming increasingly parched. Doesn't this seem, I know it's a death knell for politicians to even begin to talk about, but what's your sense of what should be done there? And is population growth less of a problem than simply conservation and better use of the water available?
Well, you can kind of think the whole problem as a supply and demand problem. Mm-hmm. So essentially, we have a shrinking supply of water, and that's because of climate change, warming temperatures, limited snowpack feeding into the larger river system. And what we've seen is we essentially have steady demand throughout the Colorado River Basin. We had large growth in the 80s, but the actual demand for water in the Colorado River Basin has remained relatively flat over the past couple decades.
You mean on a per capita basis, the absolute demand?
Over the entire watershed, mm-hmm. yes. The demand has stayed relatively the same mm-hmm. over the past couple decades. But that's a problem when you have a shrinking supply. So it creates that gap between supply and demand. Now, that's not to say that, you know, cities growing are running into water supply challenges. Absolutely they are. Mm-hmm. But it's not as large of an issue as just our overall demand for water in the Colorado River Basin for agriculture, for municipalities, for industry. You know, that it kind of has to be like an all of the above approach, because the amount of water used in municipalities is relatively small. It's about a quarter or less of the total water used in the Colorado River Basin goes towards cities.
Whereas the rest is ag mostly, right?
Right.
80% or so.
You could basically zero out water use in Phoenix, Los Angeles, the Denver metro area, and not even come close to actually fixing that supply and demand gap.
That's worth a pause. That's huge. Yeah.
So, you know, the conservation that happens in cities is important, but it's not going to be enough to actually fix the problem. It has to be all water users coming to the table, agreeing to cuts to their overall water use in order to fix this problem.
Yeah. So, Alex Hager, I want to turn back to you. So in this broader context, you know, beyond Colorado, but including, of course, we've got these upper basin states clashing with the lower basin states over who has control, who gets to use what and when and how. And they've been in these contentious negotiations, which seem to be at a stalemate now. But can you kind of bring us to the present, including give us a sense of how the tribes are supposed to be, like legally be participating, but actually haven't had much of a seat at the table? And is that changing now?
Well, right now, the states that use Colorado River water are trying to rewrite the rules for how it's shared, because the current set of guidelines expires in 2026. Mm-hmm. So they need a new set of rules to replace them. However, the timeline has been getting a little shorter because the federal government kind of came knocking at the state's door and said, hey, you know, just in case things don't go our way, this November with the election and there's an administration change, why don't we try to get some rules hammered out before the end of 2024, just to avoid any complication if, you know, the Biden administration loses the White House? So now they are under pressure to finish by the end of this year. And so far, they are not really close to an agreement. They are split into two coalitions, the upper basin states of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, and the lower basin of Arizona, Nevada, and California. And they have very different ideas for how to conserve water. The upper basin says, specifically Colorado says, look, the Colorado River mostly starts in our backyard. And because of that, we feel the sting of climate change most sharply, and we need to accommodate for the fact that in wet, in dry years, the states which are closest to the snow that creates the Colorado River, they need to have reductions to the amount of water that they send away to accommodate for the reductions delivered by Mother Nature. The lower basin states say that might be a violation of the legal foundation upon which Colorado River sharing exists, and they're not willing to go along with it. Instead, they have their own proposal. It is a new way of measuring how much water is stored in reservoirs across the West, and a new way of distributing cuts accordingly, and those cuts would be distributed across all of the states that use Colorado River water. The Upper Basin says that's not fair. So they've put their earliest draft proposals on the table. You can view them publicly, but there is still a lot of distance between them. What makes it so difficult is that you are trying to satisfy the needs of a lot of different groups. Not only do you have big cities like Denver and Phoenix and Los Angeles and Las Vegas, you have these sprawling farm fields that are producing, you know, upwards of 90% of the nation's wintertime vegetables. You also have the environment. You have the plants and animals that depend on rivers being full of water. You have 30 federally recognized native tribes that have for a long time said the reason, part of the reason we're in this crisis is because you have not been listening to us. You have not given us the opportunity to have our voices heard in talks about how the river is managed. And we would like to have a seat at the table. For the last few years, the states have said, we will give you that seat at the table. And we're seeing now in these negotiations that are going on in 2024, they clearly do not have enough voice in those talks.
And we're out of time now, but that's definitely great fodder for a follow-up show. There's so much more. That was Alex Hager, a reporter at KUNC, and Luke Runyon, radio journalist and co-director of CU Boulder's Water Desk. Alex, thanks so much. And Luke, thank you so much for coming on the show. That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Joel Parker. This week's show was produced by me, Susan Moran, and engineered by Sam Fuqua. And thanks to Joel Parker and Shelley Schlender for their headline contributions. Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on X. Questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Susan Moran.